Yeah, g'day, mate. You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m., our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews, and culture pieces from across Otepoti, Dunedin.
Welcome to R1 News at 1. It is Thursday, the 17th of October. I am one of your hosts, Charlie.
And I'm Jonah.
And up for you, we have the bulletin.
Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday, the 17th of October. I'm Jonah.
And I'm Charlie. In national news, inflation has fallen to 2.2%, which is now within the Reserve Bank's target, One News reports. Inflation in New Zealand has fallen to 2.2%, which has brought it into the Reserve Bank's target range for the first time in more than 3 years. Stats NZ announced this just a week after the Reserve Bank cut the official cash rate by 0.5%. as both institutions believe our inflation is coming under control. Stats NZ Consumer Prices Manager Nicola Groudon stated, "For the first time since March 2021, annual inflation is within the Reserve Bank of New Zealand's target band of 1 to 3%. Prices are still rising, but not as much as previously recorded. The most significant contributor to the recent annual inflation rate has been increasing rent rates, which have risen by 4.5%. Almost a fifth of the 2.2% yearly increase in the Consumer Price Index was due to these increased rents. Inflation rates in New Zealand spiked during and after the pandemic, peaking at 7.3% in the June 2022 quarter. Last week, when the Reserve Bank cut the OCR to 4.75%, they said it was based on the belief that inflation is now within the 1 to 3% target range and is heading towards the 2% midpoint. This has allowed banks to cut fixed and variable mortgage and interest rates on saving accounts to help Kiwis with the cost of living crisis we are currently facing. Finance Minister Nicola Willis has stated that today's result was more good news for New Zealanders. She noted it was, quote, "the first time the rate has been back within the Reserve Bank's target range of 1% to 3% since March 2021. The era of crushing price rises is now over. Kiwis can look forward to mortgage rate reductions, and businesses will find it easier to invest and innovate with a lower cost of borrowing." Willis has credited this decrease to the government's reducing red tape around innovation and development and rebuilding business owners' confidence. Quote, "Together with the tax relief that took effect on July 31st and the Family Boost child care payments that many families are now receiving, falling inflation and interest rates means large numbers of families are now better off than they were a year ago. There is more work to be done to get the economy growing, but New Zealanders can be confident we are headed in the right direction."
The government has been accused of copying and pasting Uber's policy on contractors and adopting it as their official policy, RNZ reports. Brooke van Velden, the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, has denied accusations for preferential treatment and said she has listened to a broad range of advice. Documents seen by RNZ showed a proposal that Uber brought to a meeting with Minister van Velden in May, which proposed changes to the Employment Relations Act. These proposed changes are similar to the new criteria of what defines a contractor, which were announced by Van Velden in September. Green Party Workplace Relations and Safety spokesperson Tiana Tuiono said, "What these documents show is that the government is deep in the pockets of big business, deep in the pockets of Uber." He added, "What they've done essentially is just cut and pasted what they've wanted. They're copying someone else's homework, a company, Uber in this case, and just dropping it in there. A situation that Tuiono described as incredibly problematic." Tuiono said that the proposed changes would prevent more people from getting their Section 6 rights, like holiday leave and sick pay. Van Velden denied preferential treatment, saying that, quote, "a range of business groups and a range of unions have been consulted, and the policy that we've landed on is an amalgamation of all of those ideas." Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff echoed Tuiono's remarks, saying that, "You only have to read what they put forward here and what the minister announced, and they're virtually the same. Picking out the smallest changes really doesn't excuse the overall impression that they followed Uber's instructions." Wagstaff said that Uber had failed in the Court of Appeal to get their way, and so, quote, "they've gone to the minister and prescribed what should be the legislative change and the policy change." He added that it looked as though Van Velden had essentially followed that word for word.
In international news, Australia's new move to attract New Zealand doctors to move across the ditch has caused concerns, Simon Mercep of One News reports. New Zealand's medical community is sounding the alarm over Australia's latest initiative to attract Kiwi doctors. The Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners has expressed concern about Australia's decision to streamline the process for New Zealand doctors wanting to work across the ditch. From Monday, doctors from New Zealand, the UK and Ireland will now no longer need individual assessments from the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners to practice in Australia. However, they will still be required to complete registration and other checks. Samantha Merton, president of the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, has criticised the move, stating, "We're way behind already. If we reduce that even further by people going easily to Australia, then our patients are going to miss out." She argued that the move was not in the spirit of ANZAC cooperation. Quote, "We expect our Australian counterparts to reflect on the fact that they're stealing from a country that's already behind the eight ball." But Nathan Cox, General Manager of Australian Health Recruitment Agency, HealthDAG, is defending this change, citing the need to address Australia's doctor shortage. Quote, "This is a really big move by the Australian government. By taking out this impediment, it provides extra incentive for GPs to consider Australia as a destination. Currently around 60 to 100 New Zealand doctors head to Australia yearly. Cox believes this number could rise significantly with this change." Health Minister Dr. Shane Ritchie acknowledged the issue, telling One News, "We've always been poached, if you like, by overseas interests, particularly from across the Tasman, because it's so close and easy to get Trans-Tasman mutual recognition. So that's a concern we'll focus on around retention." Health New Zealand confirmed the global competition for healthcare workers. "We know our workforce is in demand around the world," said Chief People Officer Andrew Slater. He added that the government is working to make it easier for internationally qualified medical professionals to come to New Zealand and practice safely. Merton also stressed the importance of keeping doctors who represent their communities. Quote, "How do we get more Pacifica doctors, a high proportion of Māori doctors, and others who represent their community working in New Zealand if they're being enticed overseas and not valued in their own country?"
Canada has expelled six Indian diplomats, including India's High Commissioner to Canada, after its police found evidence linking them to the murder of Sikh activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar in British Columbia last year. The Guardian reports. India has responded in turn by expelling six Canadian diplomats. Nijjar, a Canadian citizen, campaigned for an independent Sikh nation, known as Khalistan, to secede from India's Punjab state. The separatist movement is banned in India, and its most vocal supporters mainly reside in the Punjabi diaspora. Nijjar was designated a terrorist in July 2020 by the Indian authorities. In June last year, he was shot dead outside a Sikh temple. In September, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau publicly stated that there was credible evidence linking Indian government agents to the murder. Earlier this week, Canadian police claimed that they had found evidence which showed that senior Indian diplomats had been involved in a criminal network that had carried out homicides as well as harassing and threatening Canadian Sikhs. Prime Minister Trudeau stated that Canada had clear and compelling evidence that agents of the government of India have engaged in, and continue to engage in, activities that pose a significant threat to public safety. He added that India had made a monumental mistake in choosing to use their diplomats, an organized crime, to attack Canadians. India's government responded with outrage, calling the accusations preposterous imputations and accused Trudeau of being sympathetic to Khalistani separatists. Foreign Minister Winston Peters, in a statement on X, formerly Twitter, said, "The alleged criminal conduct outlined publicly by Canadian law enforcement authorities, if proven, would be very concerning," he said, without any mention of India. He added that, "It is important that the rule of law and judicial processes be respected and followed."
This has been the R1 News for Thursday the 17th of October. Today's bulletin was written and read to you by Charlie Cunningham and Jonah Broughton.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts or head to r1.co.nz/news.
Welcome back to R1 News at 1 on Thursday. Today we are joined by Adelaide, a fellow Radio 1 employee, to talk about the sad death of Liam Payne, the ex-One Direction member. How are you doing today, Adelaide?
Oh, it's a weird day. It's one of those moments where you're like, will remember for a long time of where were you when you found out the news that, Liam Payne passed away. Yeah, it's pretty strange. Definitely weird energy I mean, went through the room when we all found out. Yeah, so it's been a very surreal kind of couple of hours since finding out. Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely has. Were you a One Direction fan?
Yeah, I was. A big One Direction fan. It's really strange because I remember when One Direction broke up, I was in high school, and I know that like people took like bereavement leave and days off school because they were such big fans. So I'm just like definitely my like heart is out there for like all of my friends who are really, really big fans of One Direction. Like, this is, yeah, pretty significant stuff. We were just, yeah, saying before how, like, this is kind of potentially one of the first big deaths in our generation of, like, musicians passing away. Just, like, on this level of, like, you know, One Direction, pretty, pretty huge at the time. So, yeah, this feels like a real shift in sort of cultural history at the moment.
And do you feel a kind of sense of mourning and grief among One Direction fans today? So you're wearing black.
I am wearing black. I didn't know. It's the thing. I found out when I got to work. Definitely. I know there are people who are so upset that they can't even leave their house. I heard of other people, like, from friends who are, you know, absolutely distraught. I think there's definitely a sense of mourning. Play some One Direction, you know, in honour. But yeah, it's been, yeah, very surreal. I almost have no words. But yeah, I think a lot of reflection time. I think as well it's going to be really hard for like Liam's son, who's very, very young. So just keep thinking about that too. That, you know, this is while this is a celebrity who has been in one of the biggest boy bands in the world, this is also like a person who had, you know, his whānau and friends, and it would be very, yeah, it must be very strange right now for that. Yeah, very odd.
Yeah, very, very odd.
Yeah.
Anything
else to say? I think, look out for your friends today who are big One Direction fans or fans of Liam Payne. Because yeah, this is one of those strange times. Yeah.
No, yeah, definitely. Everyone make sure to look out for your friends. I know I personally have a few friends who have been quite distraught by this news, and it is a very impactful death for our generation because they were very, very important.
Yeah. Such a phenomenon.
Well, thank you, Adelaide, for coming in and talking to us about this.
All good.
Yes, I hope you feel better during the day.
Thank you.
Listen to some One Direction. And thank you. Thank you for tuning into our interview.
Kia ora and welcome back to R1 News. Today we're joined by Professor Richard Jackson and Professor Robert Patman to discuss the ongoing campaign for the University of Otago to take a BDS stance on Israel. Richard Jackson is leading thinker chair at the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies here at Otago, and his research interests include pacifism and nonviolence, critical terrorism studies, and international conflict resolution. Robert Patman is a professor of international relations in the politics department here at Otago. His research interests include global security, American foreign policy, and of course, New Zealand foreign policy. Well, thanks very much to you both for joining us today.
Pleasure.
So our first question for you today is, what is BDS and could you walk us through each letter?
Okay, yeah. No, so BDS is short for Boycott, Disinvestment and Sanctions. And it's kind of modelled on a similar campaign that kind of went around the world in the 1980s against the South African apartheid state, when the world realised that they probably wouldn't change their policies and they wouldn't get rid of apartheid without a lot of pressure. And this was kind of like a non-violent way of creating pressure. So the first thing is to boycott, which is, boycotting Israeli goods, particularly goods that are produced in the occupied territories, and boycott Israeli services and anything that's... creating wealth for Israel, which it can then use, you know, in its activities in the occupied territories or in the war. And then disinvestment. So that what that means is there are obviously companies, including companies in New Zealand, that invest in shares and stocks and so on in Israeli companies or in companies that work within Israel that might be engaged in unethical practices. And then sanctions, that's a kind of international level thing where it's sort of calling on like the United Nations and the EU and other international bodies to actually put sanctions on Israel to, you know, arms embargoes and blocking their international banking and so on. Kind of like the sanctions that they've put on Russia since the Ukraine war and the sanctions they put on Iran quite often to try and stop their nuclear program. So put those all together, that's called BDS. Mm.
And what would it look like in practice for the uni to adopt a BDS stock?
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is things like suspending academic and cultural collaborations with Israeli universities or other sort of research institutions. And, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to do that because Israeli universities are all deeply enmeshed in the overall militarism of Israel. They discriminate against Palestinian students, but they also give sort of credit and breaks to Israelis who participate in military activities, but they're also deeply entwined with, yeah, the military in terms of research and training. And then many of the, you know, like the in the legal departments, but also in political science and international relations, they provide kind of justification for Israel's wars and occupation and apartheid. And then the other thing is to publicly investigate and disclose the financial investments that a university might have, because every university has like a foundation trust. You know, we don't get enough money from the government, so we have to have funds that are earning interest, and often that involves, you know, investing in companies that might be working in Israel and helping the Israeli military, and divesting from those. And yeah, just making sure that we don't have any direct institutional ties to Israeli universities.
Hmm. Perfect. And how do you two respond to the claim that the university should maintain institutional neutrality on Israeli and Palestine? Israel and Palestine, sorry.
I think the, I think the concept of institutional neutrality, which was developed in the US in the 60s in response to student agitation over the Vietnam War, it was a way of universities acting as a host for debate, but not actually becoming, if you like, the perpetrator or the advocate of a particular position. I think it's problematic because in New Zealand, we are subject, universities are subject to the 1989 Education Act, which means that universities should be critic and conscious of society. Our university encourages all academic staff, as do other New Zealand universities, to make their expertise and their knowledge available to the wider public. The problem is, with neutrality, is that it's a contradiction between institutional neutrality and acting as critic and conscience of society. And there is an issue here because the university has pledged itself to stand by its staff when they're simply doing their job in engaging in outreach with the wider community. But as Richard and I can both testify, on certain subjects, when you engage in outreach, you sometimes walk into quite strong reactions, otherwise known as abuse. And the university would be in a very vulnerable position if it maintained institutional neutrality on issues like this, because it would be unable to protect the staff which work for it if we got reaction from critics. For example, if you had critics of BDS complaining to the university about the contributions of people like myself and Richard on this issue, the university, if it was adhering to the doctrine of institutional neutrality, they would effectively have to turn to Richard and I and other staff and say, sorry, you can't comment on this because the university must remain neutral and you're representing the university. So it's a lot of tensions and contradictions there. And I mean, I think the basic problem with institutional neutrality is this issue, this catastrophe that we've witnessed in Gaza and Lebanon, now Lebanon, is a stain on humanity. And if universities cannot take a position, an ethical and moral position, on what's happening, that brings into question their whole role within society. So, I mean, Richard may want to add to this, but I think the notion of institutional neutrality is deeply flawed. And I understand why it's developed, so that the university can act as the host for debates but not become the face of the debates. But on an issue like this, which has global ramifications, the university would, I think, bring itself into disrepute if it could not comment on issues like this, which affect not only debates within this country, but our international reputation.
If I could add something to this, I mean, an extension of Robert's argument just there is that, in fact, there's a whole bunch of international law that as a country, and therefore as a university within this country, we are sort of bound to pay heed to. And international bodies have declared that Israeli apartheid is illegal and it's wrong, and that genocide is potentially taking place, but that war crimes and things like ethnic cleansing definitely are, and that every country has a responsibility to do everything in its power to kind of stop that. So I think, you know, that removes some ambiguity in this particular case. But I would also say this university claims to be institutionally neutral, but it's not acting that way. For one thing, the most recent rollout of computing technology that they're trying to give to all the staff is from Hewlett-Packard, and they are deeply involved in helping the Israelis with their system of apartheid and some of their security systems. So we're funding a company that's actually directly engaged in oppressing Palestinians over there. But also, our university has recently advertised a fellowship that involves going to Israel and spending time at an Israeli institution. In 2022, this university made a statement on Ukraine. Now, how is it? Why is it that, you know, they will do that, but they won't make a statement on Gaza? And then informally, we've heard from students that in some divisions, students have been warned about going on protests and about wearing university gear when they do so, and that they may lose scholarships or get in trouble. Now, all of that seems to suggest that there is a kind of implicit bias against the Palestinians and against Palestinian activism, which doesn't seem institutionally neutral to me. That seems to be taking a side. And you could argue, I mean, moral philosophy professors would argue this as well, that in some situations not doing anything is taking a side because you're allowing it to happen. And I think this is one of those cases.
So going back to the disinvestment part of the BDS campaign, the university and the vice-chancellor have both said that, to the best of their knowledge, we don't have any investments in Israel. We've already sort of touched on some flaws in that. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the key phrase there is to the best of their knowledge. That sounds like a holding statement to me. Now, it may be a genuine holding statement, while the university leadership are seeking to find out exactly how the university is entangled, if it is, with Israel. On the other hand, it may also be a sort of less charitable explanation might be that the university is reluctant to come clean immediately about its financial involvement in Israel. But we will, we will wait to see. But it's worth pointing out that other New Zealand universities have gone down this step, haven't they, Richard?
They have. Other universities have said the same thing and then done a search and found that they actually are investing. So I think that's the point, is we need some transparency. Mm. We need a rigorous accounting to be sure. And if at the end of it, the university is sure, well, then that's fantastic. Mm. But I don't think we can live with the ambiguity, not on such an important issue.
I would just say, in fairness to the university, we have a new vice chancellor who's been in the job 100 days or so, and he's in the process of getting to grip. So I think you have to give him the benefit of the doubt on this. It's a big institution. He's inherited a team that's been there for some time. So he's on a voyage of discovery as well. So I don't think I think we should err on the side of generosity when he says so far he's unaware of sort of financial involvement with Israel. But I agree with Richard. The other thing we ought to keep in mind here is that New Zealand's a publicly funded university. That is to say, it's government funded, and the government recently voted for an ICJ advisory ruling, which was that the occupation of Palestinian territories is unlawful. We voted for that. So the New Zealand government official position is that Israel's occupation of East Jerusalem, West Bank and Gaza is unlawful. So I don't think the university can be at odds with the body that funds it.
And there are some people who object to an academic and cultural boycott, because Israelis in those institutions may be highly critical of their government. What's your guys' take on this?
I actually think the reverse. I think people in Israel, as journalists like Gideon Levy and academics we could mention, are very frustrated at the compliance not only of policymakers in the United States with the Netanyahu government, but also many Western leaders. I think people who are critical of Netanyahu want him to be brought to account. And I think the fact that a university like our own could take a BDS initiative would actually reinforce the position of internal critics, not weaken them within Israel, because they'd be able to point out, look, have we got it wrong? The rest of the world, or many members of the rest of the world, think we've got it wrong, and we're, in serious transgression of international laws and norms. And how are they going to get that message if everybody adheres to institutional neutrality?
And I think the other point is that, this boycott doesn't say you can't work with individuals in Israeli institutions, in the sense that, you can, I suppose, have dialogue with them. That's not a problem. What we're talking about are institutional supports that give legitimacy and perhaps financial support and publicity and so on to Israeli universities, thereby saying these are legitimate organizations and these, we see them as being institutionally neutral as well. The fact is, there's a lot of research to show the ways in which every single Israeli university is deeply involved in, the occupation, the apartheid, and in some cases the genocide. And so it's those institutional collaborations, those institutional links, and the kind of big research projects and the exchange and the supporting their grant applications and supporting publishing their work, that's the problem. That's not to say we can't, have a dialogue and a relationship with individual Israelis, particularly if they're fighting for Palestinian rights in their own institutions. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that this campaign would always say is that if there's going to be any, a condition of any work with an Israeli university is that Israeli university has to have Palestinian scholars and a collaboration with a Palestinian university in it. Now, given what's happened in Gaza, the fact that they've detonated and destroyed every single university, that's clearly not possible anymore. So, that's where the realities of the situation, which is that the Israeli universities are up to their eyeballs in the suppression, kind of makes that point a little bit moot.
And one of the reasons I think this BDS initiative is so important for this university is because one of the key institutions which is responsible for maintaining global peace and security, namely the UN Security Council, is paralyzed by the use of the veto. In other words, the institutions set up to do their job are dysfunctional and can't do it. And so how else can we start launching grassroots initiatives that begin to, if you like, question the legitimacy of what the Israeli government is doing. And I think this is an important step in the right direction.
Right, so we have to wrap up in 1 minute, but any final remarks you'd like to share before we finish?
Well, I'd just like to say this, you know, Otago is not on its own here. Many universities around the world are taking this up, and I just read, I think yesterday, about Trinity College in Ireland that's doing an investigation and adopting a BDS position. So we would be following in the footsteps of other prominent universities around the world that are adopting the same thing.
Yeah, and I think it's consistent with how many New Zealanders see their place in the world. We often see ourselves as a plucky little country that's prepared to speak up when injustices are in play, and I think this step shows that we haven't forsaken that role for political convenience.
Mm. Well, thank you very much to you both. That's Professor Robert Patman and Professor Richard Jackson.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to R1 News at 1, here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts, or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.
Yeah, now, Siebs, that was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.